take a chance to thank the organizers and director for, I think, a fantastic program, fantastic hospitality, and I think, you know, Neil's vision he expressed at the beginning of this being a fantastic resource for the community is really borne out. I think we've all had a good time. Every time I come here, it's intellectually scintillating, and the resources and the good times are much appreciated. So let's give them all a hand.
This
is actually three topics. For an earlier conference this summer, I was asked, what am I going to talk about? And I couldn't decide among three, and then I realized there was a reason that there's some interesting interconnections between the topics that I'm going to talk about. And the starting point is actually, so these are all have to do with the challenges of constructing a whole theory of, I've got some over here. And in the bulk over there. So they do with the challenges of having a theory of the whole universe. And I recall in the 80s when cosmology was kind of newly becoming a very hot topic, that in a way that had a lot of people excited and a lot of people claiming things that were absolute crap, but also producing lots of resentment from other people, when people say, how can you possibly study a theory of the whole universe when we don't even know how to apply quantum mechanics to the whole universe? So I took that to heart at some stage in my career and went off and studied that stuff a bit and decided I was enough of an Everettian that I didn't care. I wasn't bothered by the questions of the quantum theory of the universe, except in subtle ways that didn't stop me in any practical sense. And so I was very content with that. But since then, two of these topics I'm talking about have kind of shaken that to some degree and suggested there are other aspects that make things uncomfortable. So the topics for today are the clock ambiguity. And I have some papers, a couple with Iglesias on that. What I like to call the Bournemouth crisis, which is what Don has talked about, and we've had some nice conversations here about that, and I want to add which is good, I don't have to take up too much time talking about that here now, but I want to add my own twist to some of that. And to me, it's a crisis. So up front, I think to me, the Born rule is something that I'm very grateful to the Born rule because it saved me in the 80s from worrying about too much about quantum mechanics and just going ahead and doing cosmology. Lots of people seem happy just to add another layer of theory and say, well, Born rule doesn't help me, so I'm going to do something else. But for me, it feels like a crisis because I thought it was something solid I could count on. And so I'm struggling with certain aspects of that. And then the age-old question, what is the state of the universe, which everyone knows is an important problem. And I have my own specific comments I want to make about that. So I'm going to push some ideas about the sitter equilibrium, which I've written about with Sorbo. So let me tell you what the clock ambiguity is. So typically in quantum cosmology, people consider an internal time parameter. And this is where formally we have this, and then we look at an internal time parameter that that we have to extract by identifying some part of the superspace in which this state lives as the time parameter, and look at correlations with that time parameter to determine how the system evolves. And I'd like to set that up in a particular simple way that will then let me proceed with my argument. So we consider a superspace that's decomposed as the clock subspace and the rest subspace. And we can write a state. We can have a basis for each of these that lets us decompose, well, lets us make a complete basis for the superspace, and lets us decompose the, and I like to, really the, all that matters here is the label I, but I call it TI to remind us that it's the clock. And then there's coefficient alpha ij. So this is, I would argue, in any of the classic papers on internal time and quantum cosmology could be, you know, expressed this way. I happen to be taking a discrete point of view to make formulas simple, but I don't actually, when I first started doing this, I thought there might be something pretty subtle about that, but I don't think so at this point. We can talk about that later. Let me just show you where this is going. So one thing we can do is sum over j. So we have these bases spanning each state, but we can define psi in the rest. Let's call it phi in the rest at time ti is equal to sum over j alpha I j, where I is now fixed. We're just summing over j in the rest subspace. So that's the state. So this represents the state at of the rest at time ti. So you think about time evolution by posing conditional probability questions, where you say if the time parameter is at this particular time, at this particular value, what is the state of the rest? And based on that, posing those kind of questions, you can get time evolution out of the of this formalism. Any questions or comments about that? So this is meant to be very standard. Nothing new here. So you're asking what happened to good old time, like on the clock there. One thing I like about this is that this is exactly how we normally do use time. This could well, you know, formally this could well be that clock. Of course, no one's done cosmological models with enough detail to put that particular clock in. But, and so often this is a scale factor or a scalar field that people are doing. But in the spirit is that that's could be any clock. And of course, there's something very interesting about our world where there's lots of different clocks that cooperate to mean the same thing. And that's an interesting fact about physics. But it doesn't detract from that you can do, it doesn't stop you from doing this. So that statement would be that, yeah, you can have this time, and then you look in here and say, wow, there sure are a lot of good clocks that are ticking away nicely in correlation with that. Yeah.
You might as well, you can always.
So are you imagining that H is really the sum of two pieces?
So this is the sort of the master H, but then there's H's that live only in R that describe the time evolution. And so that's a different, that's a
different
notion. So you take your phase space, if you want to think and continue with, and isolate one parameter. So the classic thing is to say the scale factor. So these classic papers where people take a scale factor and think of it as a time variable, and look at how a scalar, how a homogeneous scalar field
correlates with that and call that the time evolution of the scalar field. So that's one example, sort of common example. So we have this, and this gives us time evolution, and I actually think this is pretty robust. There's people
who worry about the different problems you run into with different kinds of definitions of time and quantum gravity, and I actually think this is pretty robust, and I'm happy to talk later with people who worry about what about this problem, or what about what Kukoc said, or that kind of thing. But I think I think this is pretty in pretty good shape in that respect. So now I want to make a claim. So all the information about the time evolution of the system, so the initial state and the Hamiltonian in the rest spaces is present in the alpha ij. So that's where all the important information is. And now my claim is that by simply choosing a different clock rest decomposition, I can get any state evolving according to any Hamiltonian. So there's absolute ambiguity in choosing the clock. That's the claim I want to make. And I'm going to show you explicitly how to do that. So the first thing along the way is to say, you tell me, okay, so we're talking about a specific story, a specific initial state evolving according to a specific Hamiltonian. And now you tell me which alternate one you want me to come up with. And the first step, we just say, okay, well, that's some new state in superspace with a new set of expansion coefficients. And sure enough, there's nothing to stop you from doing that. You just give a new wave function, a new time evolution, and there you have it. And so now I want to show you what I'm going to do. So this is now a new state in superspace. And what I'm going to show you is that I can go back to the old state in superspace and construct an alternative breakdown of the space into clock cross rest and get these alpha primes in this expansion with primes instead of on the alpha, sorry, primes on the C and R instead of on the superspace. So first of all, I'm going to construct an operator so some operator M on psi prime is, so this is the definition of M. Yeah. So that would be, yes, that would be in the alpha ij's. That information would be the Schrodinger equation. So Schrodinger equation has external time. And so the Schrodinger equation would be what these guys obey. So this is basically gives me a list of for T1, T2, and so on, phi. At phi at T1, so on. So this gives me a list, and then it's up to the laws of physics that gave me these alphas to give me the time evolution. Yeah, the whole works. Yeah, and you, of course, you have to resolve this into what your Hilbert space for that problem is, and so on. So I want to
come back to time independent Hamiltonian, because it's pretty interesting, and I have a place reserved for that. So interesting question. I'm going to save it for a little bit later. So because I'll just say at first blush, if I'm saying I can get anything out, it seems like I'm including time dependent Hamiltonians as a general rule, because I haven't promised you anything. I promised you any alpha ij. And that doesn't seem to involve a promise about the time dependence of the Hamiltonian. So the time independence. So I'm just going to go step by step, though. So I have I construct an operator that transforms this into this. It's very easy to do. There's many options, because all I'm requiring it to do is operate on one state. I'm only constraining it to what it does on one state.
And then I go ahead and operate on this equation. So I take this, go across the board, and just operate on that equation. And so then I get rid of the prime on the right, on the left. And then I still have my alpha ij prime here. And then I have m operating on basis. Now, this is the step where I like to use a crutch. Some people like it. Some people immediately see where I'm going and don't need the crutch. But I'm going to use the crutch. If you already get it, bear with me. So I like to, at this point, look at this. This is a basis state in the superspace, this combination. And I like to say, well, I can do a one-to-one mapping between k and the ordered pair I and j to define a relabeling. This is just a relabeling as state k in the superspace. So this is just a definition. This is just a relabeling. I can relabel any time anything I want. And then I can define m on k in the superspace as defined as k prime in the superspace. So I just operate and get a new state. And then I can use this same one-to-one correspondence to undo this labeling and just say that's defined as so I undo the labeling, but in doing so I have to put primes on clock and rest, because there's no guarantee that these now reflect the same subdivision, S, the same decomposition of S into clock cross rest. So this defines some new decomposition. And then I'm done. So then I say, and I've given you what I promised. So you give me the initial state and the time evolution you want, and I will construct a new clock that I could have chosen in my original superspace, and I'll get that story of the universe out for you. Just based on choosing a new clock. So let me stand back a minute and talk a little bit about what I think this means. So on the face of it, it means, for example, that we have the laws of physics we know and love, and we build the LHC, and we go and learn more about the laws of physics and come up with a very concrete idea of what some fundamental field theory is that describes at least low energy physics in our world. And then we look, and then in the library there's all these, on the archive there's all these papers where people proposed other theories that turned out to be wrong, so we forget about them. Except for with another clock, one of those other theories is right, and presumably someone else is winning a Nobel Prize for the that particular theory. So it all seems very, to me this was very disturbing, and I don't know. It's interesting how, it's maybe an interesting Rorschach test, what degree of disturbing people find this. To me, it was very disturbing. It's not how I grew up doing physics. And let me just add something important. This is very much a cosmological problem. This is not something, let's think for a second what the equivalent of this would be for laboratory physics. If I walk into a laboratory in my physics building and see a theorist and experimentalist trying to understand some results from an experiment, and the theorist is doing some calculation. And I say, oh, nice calculation. What if we rearrange the Hilbert space? So this thing that, you know, used to be the electron now gets mixed in with the probe and with the electric field, and I totally rearrange the Hilbert space. I wonder what that would look like. You know, they should just throw me out of the office because I'm just slowing them down. That's not what you're supposed to do with quantum mechanics in the laboratory. So this comes about when people do the following in cosmology, which is very common nowadays in cosmology, is you think about some giant wave function of the universe, and you ask yourself, where do semi-classical degrees of freedom start to emerge, and what kind of physical world do those degrees of freedom describe? So once you start fishing around in your wave function of the universe for emergent semi-classical behavior, then certainly part of that is trying to find the right clock. Now, there's no particular reason to think these different regions of semi-classical behavior are all going to have the same clock. And so this becomes part of the question, which clock are you choosing? And then you get stuck with this ambiguity. So it's a very much cosmological problem. And maybe the answer is that you shouldn't do cosmology that way. And maybe the answer is to pull back from some of that grand thinking. But then we have to ask ourselves exactly how what we should be doing instead. But I'm actually very open. I think one of the important questions this should provoke is, you know, is there something wrong with the assumptions going into this? And I'm quite happy to consider that. But I'm not going to consider that anymore during my talk. Instead, I'm going to ask a different question. Suppose this is right. Suppose this is really true about the physical world. Where does that get us? And it gets us in the position of trying to ask, and I think we had at least one, maybe two questions of sort of what it means to choose a good clock. And that becomes an important question. And I have some ideas about that, and then a little calculation that I'm going to just illustrate briefly about where that takes you. And I think it's kind of fun. So you could ask, what does it take to give a good clock? And in this language, what does it take to give good laws of physics? Yeah. Yeah, M acting on K, I'm defining as a new state. Is some operator operating on the state gives you a new state? So sorry, it's the prime, maybe the prime goes here or something. It's not that I just put a new integer into this thing. So it's a whole new family of, it's a whole new basis. So if I expanded in these k's, then it should be a sum. But you've exposed a flaw in my labeling, I think. So this is m on k is some state. And I want to label it. And I want to call it k because it inherits the k from this. So I want to call it k, but I want the prime to go somewhere. Maybe I should have put it here, not. Yeah, but. So the prime, but it's understandable. I think Tommy was confused about my notation in an understandable way, but I hope I've explained it. How'd I do? Yeah. But it's a brand new basis. I have no a priori prejudice about its relationship to K except via M, which could be a very arbitrary thing. So it's not a. So I'm assuming I have enough of a measure defined in the superspace to do these manipulations, and then in terms of normalizing probability summing to unity, that drops out automatically because you're posing conditional probability questions. And when you do that, you always divide by the total probability. So the rules of conditional probabilities cause you to generate normalized wave functions in the rest for free. Providing you can do that, right. Well, I think so that this is a topic that always comes up here, and my impression is that people who really think they can do that someday there should be a good theory of quantum gravity expect this level of control over the superspace. There is in particular instances, in particular approximations, there's problems that come up along the way, but that's right. And people, for example, should right. So I'm assuming a simple answer to that. And well, I think the idea is if you do have a good quantum theory of gravity, many people think it should give you this. Now, maybe that's where this comes unraveled. Yeah, disagree how and where, yeah, but it, so yeah, I'm trying to leapfrog that and say, suppose they succeed, what are the consequences? So the concrete realization means write down some fields and some familiar Lagrangian.
So if you know boundary wave function, for instance, if you try to get a clock by using these complex saddle points, it will depend on the variables that you use. Different histories you can use the same classically for different in different variables. I don't know what that means, but it's related to that.
Yeah, so I think there's lots of concrete
relations.
My guess would be that all the different all the different realizations of string theory are probably related to this.
Oh, yeah, something a lot simpler, like you give some Hilbert space that has the structure C cross R. And some operator that
annihilates
the function when you write the
function. So let me give you a different answer to that. So I stumbled across this long ago when I was fiddling around. I'd done a simple realization of a quantum measurement quotes where I put the apparatus and the system in the wave function, done a little calculation to show how everything worked out. And I thought, so before I move on, I'll try to give an illustration of internal time. And I started writing a concrete realization and realized that it was that it just depended on whatever basis I chose to interpret it, regardless of what H I put in at the beginning and all that. So I think this is such a trivial thing that I don't. I mean,
say if you got a relativistic particle, that would have a constraint.
Sorry.
Time diffeomorphism in a relativistic particle. It's got a constraint, and there's a well-defined way to put a norm on that, which is my Gordon norm. And you can do the same on the, the DeWitt wave function as well.
So I think it must be possible to do a lot of these. Yeah. If you want to think about this in the functional formalism method. There's some papers by Vedder and that I think are the exact same thing. I haven't checked every detail, but in that language, the question becomes which degrees of freedom do you call your metric and which degrees of freedom do you call your other degrees of freedom, and you wind up with very similar sort of consequences that you could have anything depending on what you choose. So other questions? I'm gonna now take a particular. Suppose we really are, our job is really to find a good clock and shop around in the wave function of the universe for different laws of physics. But one I think, nice fundamental principle that might be helpful is the idea that, now this is getting anthropic, I have to admit, although I'm trying to do it in a way that I think is very, very conservative. And it's not about what it takes life to exist. You could say this, but it's an observation that in our world, that the way we depend on, the law, one important way we depend on the laws of physics is to keep us approximately decoupled from the rest of the world. So if you say, here we are, we're tiny subsystems in this giant universe, it's critical for our survival. The fact that we survive and even thrive to some degree is based on the fact that we don't experience an arbitrary Hamiltonian. My interaction, for example, with this building has many more degrees of freedom than I do, but I can model it in my little brain. I can model it well enough to use it, to utilize it, and to keep those degrees of freedom from destroying me, as long as it's built properly. And so you could ask, in an arbitrary Hamiltonian, why isn't there some incredibly strong matrix element in the Hamiltonian between me and Pluto, or something that would be instantly destructive? So we depend, I like to call quasi-separability. We can't be completely decoupled from everything else, but we're pretty close to decoupled. So the laws of physics accommodate separability. The way that's realized in our physical world is through locality. To write the laws of physics this way is a huge reduction compared to all possible Hamiltonians you could write down, and its locality, that tells us that that ultimately is the reason for the quasi-separability. I'm not strongly coupled with the building because I'm in a different place from the physical substance of the building, different place from Pluto, and so on. And this is the origin of the quasi-separability. This is a fundamental aspect of the laws of physics that makes things work out for us. Now, you can say, well, field theory, in some sense, is the ultimate expression of locality. It's kind of what defines field theory in a certain sense. And so you can imagine sort of following logic where you look for quasi-separability, you look for, you might see field theory emerge, and you try to sort of have a top-down approach of deriving laws favorable to small systems existing. So those are words, those are ideas. What I've done with that is sort of move completely to sort of the other end of the problem and just jump to the sort of answer at the end of the book and say, well, our field theory, suppose we randomly generate a set of laws of physics, randomly generate a Hamiltonian, to what extent might that be consistent with field theory? And to do that, I made a comparison, Alberto Iglesias and I made a comparison, at the level of the density of states. So we just look at the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian and ask, to what extent are the laws of, are random, is a random Hamiltonian consistent with a field theory? Now, it turns out there's a lot of work on what a random Hamiltonian would look like, and it gives you the Wigner semicircle. This is something that, in the limit of a large Hamiltonian, gives that type of density of states. So formally, you start this idea starts by assuming a finite matrix with this finite Hamiltonian with Gaussian distributions for the matrix elements. Then people show that you can actually relax the Gaussian assumption and still get this in a sort of central limit type of result. So random gives you a Wigner semicircle, and field theory
gives you some exponential thing. And at which point, we might think we were done. And the answer is no. but we didn't quite give up. So let me show you what we did. Exponential. This is density. So this is including.
But what are you talking about
exactly? This is the density, the all eigenvalues. So this is not.
Just saying entropy goes up as a power.
Yeah. The number of states. Number of states is a function of the function of energy.
It's a super exponential, isn't it? Exponential of a power law.
It's an exponential
of state.
There's two things that are often called density of states, and this is. You're thinking of the. You see what I'm. This is the total.
This is the multi-particle
density of states. Yes. That's and so we had these two things, and we almost gave up. And then I said, wait a second, let's just double check. So. We actually said, we don't know. We only probe the field theory in some finite region. So we have the universe, and we have an energy for the universe, and we interpret it as a field theory for energy eigenvalues around the energy of the universe. We never see the ground state, the real ground state for the universe. There's always, Pluto and galaxies are always still there. We never see the ground state in the field theory. There's always lots of matter around. So we only ever probe a field theory around a pretty high energy. And so we said, let's try to match these order by order in a Taylor series. And what you end up doing is messing around. The other thing I've done is say, well, I don't really know yet what's happening with gravity in this picture. So I allowed myself an energy offset that allowed me to do this. So this is field theory. This is linear. And so it turns out to zeroth. So I can set these exactly equal to zeroth order just by fixing the size of the Hilbert space. So the size of the random matrix. I can set these precisely equal at zeroth order.
Zeroth order in what?
So I'm expanding around E naught, and there's some delta E, some range of energies, which ultimately is the range of energies, and this is going to be related to the time scale on which I think field theory is valid. So this picture is going to tell me. I expect field theory to only be an illusion. It should break down as I probe a range of energies that probes the deviation between these two curves. There's some delta E that characterizes my experimental probes of this so far, and I want to ask how controlled, to what degree do I expect, to what degree have I already encountered breakdown. So what limits do I set here? So zeroth order, I can play with the size of the Hilbert space and get these to match exactly. At first order, I have this offset that I play with to get the slope right. So I feel I've allowed myself freedom. I don't feel too apologetic about just doing that. Setting them equal. Then in second order, you can see that you can't set them equal. They're the wrong sign. One's curving up and one's curving down. So that's where I started. So that's where we have to start talking about some numbers. And
can I ask you about the zero power? So N is NR. Is a dimensionless thing, right?
Right.
So there's no dimensionless parameter.
So there's
So what's the actual?
So for example, there's a there's a regulator in field theory, delta k spaces. So I can show you all the formulas. There's a regulator in field theory. Really, this is a lower. Depending on the regulator, you get different ends.
So basically, you're saying NR turns out to be something like the beta 12 over the
naught. Yes, exactly. So at second order, the sort of fractional gap at second order is given them. Here's the K space regulator. Here's the delta E. I already told you about this is the energy of the universe. This is the discreteness in K space. And you can choose different things for these quantities. It turns out this alpha is, there's different ideas. So there's this different ideas about what this might be depending on whether you include Casimir energy and various things. So this turned out to be the most important thing. For conformal field theory, it's a half. For conformal field theory, it's related to the dimension of space but there's speculation that with Casimir modes it winds up being half. There's different ideas about alpha, but the upshot is that you can put in different quantities that you expect. You can put in for here, you can put in maybe the photon mass is your idea of what sets the scale here. Maybe it's the Hubble constant. The energy of the universe is kind of ADGV. Maybe the but the upshot is that you can get very small numbers for this. And so here, let's see, delta E, we put it in 1 over delta time, which can come from cosmic rays or accelerator physics.
Isn't the energy of the universe zero?
No. So I'm just adding it up. I mean, in a field theory, it's not. I mean, field theory, there's all this matter around. So it's where are you on this curve? There's all this matter. So you plug in these numbers and you can get very small values, and it seems fine. I want to go on, so I'm not going to sort of get into the great detail of that. But my claim is that at this very naive level, you can take any random Hamiltonian that's large enough and interpret it as a field theory as much as we ever have a right to claim field theory is right. So you can find a field theory. It's totally not really a field theory, but we don't know. Field theory. The whole field theory is a huge extrapolation from our own experiences, and our own experiences are just picking up a little piece of the density of states.
Sorry, you're saying you can get the density of states to match.
Yes,
the first order.
Right.
But none of the other structure of the field theory has been.
So the simple thing to say is I'm not checking that. So I'm doing the check at the basis of the density of states. I believe that the remaining structure, again, has to do with how I decompose the rest into field operators and so on. And I would think that that should be possible to do. One of the interesting features has to do with what I have to assume about the state to get locality and so on. And that's going to come up in a little bit again in this talk. But I've only really done the check at the level of the density of states. I'm
confused. You have a theory of field theories. So can you compute, say, the time variation of the fine structure constant? I mean, in principle.
In principle. So let me. Here's the challenge. So, to what extent do simple considerations lead to predictions? To what extent do you have a preference for one symmetric group over another? To what extent do you have a preference for certain representations over another? And I don't know. So what I've done is I've taken this puzzling thing and said, what if we just try this? And if I'm in an optimistic mood, or if a particular character is in an audience when I'm giving a talk about this, they say, oh, Holger Nielsen has this idea how you have a preference for one set of symmetries and one specific representations to do with how things run from my energies. And maybe there's stuff like that going on. Maybe this is a complete disaster. I honestly don't know. But if this were to work, yeah, I should be able to predict fine structure constants. It's hard to, it's nowhere near, trying to make that claim.
But on the other hand, you're saying that the Hamiltonian doesn't really matter. So Hamiltonian with one, fine structure constant is equivalent according to the logic.
So then, without saying it explicitly, I kind of turned this around and said, can we make any predictions at all?
Yes.
That's the question. And at the level of, so I would say there's been some marginal success in that regard. And the marginal success has been, well, I want to look for quasi-separability. I know I want to look for physical laws that allow subsystems to survive and interact in some ways with other subsystems. So then I could ask, well, what's the most likely way of realizing quasi-separability? And I regard field theory as the optimal way of realizing quasi-separability, and it turns out that's easy to realize. So my claim is that if my agenda, my rules of the road is I look for quasi-separability, and the answer is I can go all the way to the ultimate quasi-separability with any random Hamiltonian, that's, in some sense, a prediction that we should have field theory. The drive toward quasi-separability can take us all the way to field theory.
But that's on the basis of matching
at the level, right,
derivative of the density of states. You were saying that implies
and not getting the second derivative, and getting the second derivative to, well,
be small,
sufficiently small for the probes we've made. So the prediction is that at some point field theory will fail.
Yeah.
And at some point we'll do experiments to probe this, and we discover it's not that. And you could ask, do we already have evidence?
Wait, we can't do the experiments. We're not changing energy. Energy is conserved.
Well, we're not in an eigenstate. Well, we're not in an eigenstate. So to describe our state, we need a range of energies to describe our state, and that's where the time dependence comes in. So that's
pretty hard to change
energy. Okay, we don't change the expectation value, but we can examine. We're probing a range of energies. We know we're not in an energy eigenstate. So
are we? I mean, that was the point of Wooters by thinking evolution without evolution, doing this clocking.
So we're an eigenstate of that guy,
right?
But we still have real time evolution. So we still have real time evolution. We still have the Schrodinger equation, and then that level, what we buy?
But I don't know. But I mean, even if we were in the Minkowski,
but you teach it. You teach it to your undergraduates.
So then we're talking about different energies then.
Yeah.
So but
right.
The one on the top is the energy of the super Hamiltonian. The one on the filter is the energy
of the rest. And
so why should the two have anything to do with each other?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't think, on the face of it, this is a ridiculous project. I was stunned that I got away with this much. That's all I'll say. And I don't want to be seen as overstating how many failure modes hover to destroy this. But I just want to say that I just find it intriguing. So I'm putting this out as a challenge, not as a like this is what, the way we should all be trained in physics, but it's intriguing to me.
Well, let me go back to the question of the time dependence of the Hamiltonian. So naively, if you're pulling any alpha ij out of a hat, it would seem that in general you'd be describing time a time dependent Hamiltonian. But then when you think about it, you realize that the only thing you're describing is the evolution of one state from one time to the next. And if the Hilbert space is size n, that's constraining n matrix elements of the Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian has n squared. So you can, without loss of generality, assume you can describe any list of these states up to n of them with a time-independent Hamiltonian without loss of generality. So up to a point, you can just assume the Hamiltonian is time-independent. And if you ask, you know, if you assume that time steps in the universe are Planck length or something, and ask sort of what does n need to be? Well, you have exponentials of exponentials. So the constraint on nr here is very great. It's e to the 10 to the 50 or something coming from the fact that we know
field theory is very good down to a pretty high resolution. Whereas the time steps, the number of Hubble times in the history of the universe is just 10 to the 60 or so. So there's plenty of, so we're far from saturating our ability to assume a constant Hamiltonian. So that's what I have to say about that. You asked.
Demands we could make of these blocks and of the Hamiltonian and so on, that would allow us to get something more conventional out. I mean, I think you've proven this. I don't think there's anything wrong with your proof. Is there a reasonable set of assumptions we could make?
So I'm saying you get, so as far as I can tell, within the parameters we need, we get a time independent Hamiltonian for free. So that's not going to help. It's going to challenge us to think, if we have a theory of the universe where the Hamiltonian has to be constant for eternity, that's not going to work. So you're going to run out of time. And in fact, you're going to run out of time in much less than one recurrence time if you want to think of the sitter recurrence. So there's that. But you've got plenty, in terms of the history of the universe, you've got plenty of time under constant physical.
Have you thought of trying to make more demands? I mean, so obviously time and time have some isn't good enough.
Well, okay, so if you want to ask me what do I think is the most practical thing to try to do with this? To me, the intriguing thing is to run this through again. So where does Poincaré invariance come in to this? It comes in through the dispersion relation in the field theory when you calculate density of states. So I'm curious to imagine field theory with a different dispersion relation. Propagate that through and ask if there's any natural constraints on dispersion relation that would maybe cause me to prefer Poincaré invariance. So to me that's a potentially tractable next step, but I haven't done much with it. So who's watching the time and how much do I have left? We did start right on time, but I don't know how.
We started 10 minutes late, so it's 15 minutes.
Okay, yeah, that's funny. So I think I told you everything I know about this. I provoked some thoughts. I agree it's weird. I don't want it to sound like I think this is not weird, but it's fun. And I'm curious where it will take us. And I guess the only other thing, maybe the only other sort of spin I put on this is that one of the things that transformed, so I felt very weirded out about this, but I think if it succeeds, if you really can find some reason to argue that certain laws are more likely to emerge than others, I think I actually think that would be a more robust understanding of the origin of physical laws than
just someone writing down a Lagrangian and checking, you know, finding a workout of LHC. So I think it's challenging, and there's no particular reason to think it would work out. But I think you either this is going to work, or you need to disassemble some of the framework that got you here. That's what I would say. So I think it's very interesting. I don't think you can just dismiss this. I think you have to either talk about trying to do physics under these conditions, or undermine the argument in some way. And either of those directions is very interesting.
Just a quick question. What happens if you do UV cutoff on the field theory?
I do. But I get it shows up here. Oh, sorry, that's a. I don't think it didn't show up as a major piece of this. It was the.
But that should be right. Because your energy cannot go above something, so that should cut it off somehow.
Well, it's. Let's talk about that. I'd have to remember how that went through, but it didn't seem to be a driver of the shape of this density of states. Because I think because it's mainly multi-particle states rather than single particle.
So I think this would change something.
So I don't think anyway. We can look at that. Born rule crisis. We've had a lot of nice discussion about that. What I would just add it's just some comments, which is I'm intrigued. I've just got a few minutes left. I'm going to assume people remember we're at Don's talk and remember the gist of this point, which I like to say is just. If you're going to measure a system and there's equivalent copies of what you're going to measure and you don't know which one you're going to measure, you can't use the Born rule to predict probabilities for what you're going to get. You simply can't. It's simply an ill-posed question in quantum mechanics. It's interesting that we've encountered that situation already in quantum mechanics in the name of identical particles. And we've saved ourselves from that problem by imposing part of the identical particle rules, which require symmetrized or anti-symmetrized wave functions. And under those conditions, you can predict the answer because it doesn't matter which of the particles you're going to measure. And so these are conditions. So I'm intrigued that if we didn't have those constraints, we'd actually have been looking at the failure of the Born rule already in everyday practical laboratory experiments. So I think it's interesting to reflect on that, and also to consider whether the Born rule, whether the type of resolution we get from the identical particle rules is appropriate in cosmology. I think there was a question from Alex Lenten. During Don's talk, what if your wave function predicts the same thing for all the observers? That's one possible outcome, but I don't think we normally expect that to be the case for the kind of wave functions we're thinking of these days in cosmology. And so I just put on the list here, compare with identical particle. And the other is to pose the question, maybe the Hilbert space just isn't that big. So in the interest of time, I'm not going to, I have some thoughts about the sort of pros and cons, whether you think this is going to be a good solution, but I'm just going to leave that as a provocation at this stage. But it is, on the face of it, it's another example where the laws of
you know, the attempts to do physics of the whole universe get you into trouble using quantum mechanics as we know it. And just another comment, by the way, you can easily, in Don's toy example, you can show that if you symmetrize or anti-symmetrize in that those simple little two-state spaces, you're fine in terms of the Born rule. You achieve the sort of same success as you do with identical particles, and you don't run into ambiguities with the Born rule. So, last minute or two comments on the state of the universe. I think the infinities that we face with eternal inflation lead to the notorious measure problem that people struggled in very clever ways for a long time and not really cracked, as far as I can tell. On the other hand, there's, you know, if you take this line of reasoning, I would say this gives us a prejudice toward the analysis of the clock ambiguity, gives us a prejudice toward a finite Hilbert space, if no other reason than we're looking for the emergence of laws approximately like the ones we observe, and we certainly don't have any basis to assume there really is an infinite physical space. A finite Hilbert space will help you out for sure with the Born rule. So maybe we've got to take that more seriously. And what I'll do is just mention I have a particular fondness for the following finite picture. So suppose the cosmological constant is really truly constant. Then the sitter space you approach at late times is a lot like an equilibrium state. It's, first of all, it's a state you approach no matter where you start. It has a quantified entropy, which is maximal compared to all the other perturbations you could produce. And it has a temperature, the Hawking temperature of the de Sitter space. If that were the correct picture of the universe, and plus you can take a sort of a particular form of holographic dogma and say that the number of states is e to the f lambda equal to e to the 10, 120. So you can think of it. The horizon really defines a finite physical system, and there's a finite number of states you need to describe it. This obviously isn't the only way people choose to think about it, but it's one way. Under those conditions, you have a finite system, it's in equilibrium, and the job of cosmology becomes the study of fluctuations out of equilibrium. There's a couple of things I find very appealing about that. One is that you that there's no initial state. So in equilibrium, you just have equilibrium. It's eternal. Cosmology is the study of fluctuations. There's no question about the initial state. By the way, this is a lot like, so far, it's a lot like what Tanne was talking about, although there's different important differences in how I go about studying this. There's no initial state. And the probabilities are just given by the laws of physics or the Hamiltonian. In the thermal system, the probability for fluctuations are in principle well defined by the thermal behavior, so by the stat mech of that system. So to me, it has some really elegant features. And then by definition, it's finite and is not going to totally run away from you. There's very simple ways based on, you can use a simple ergodic approach, which Matt Cleven and his friends have done to ultimately say that the probability for fluctuation is just E to to the e to the minus s fluctuation over s lambda based on just exploring all the number of states which are associated, all the states, states consistent with the fluctuation. This is just logarithm of that number of states. This is going to be smaller than the total. You can do an analysis. Did I? Yeah, right. I do want to. Thank you. E s plus minus s lambda, and you can then one of the competing fluctuations is a small perturbation, and it's actually there's systematic ways you can understand these. If it's a localized mass, the horizon shrinks in a de Sitter space if you put a localized mass in it, and you can calculate the entropy of a particular fluctuation. You can allow certain fluctuations to tunnel via a Guth-Fahey process into inflation, and you can compare that with, for example, Boltzmann brains. And this is where I differ from Tanmay, who didn't want to worry about Boltzmann brains so much. I care a lot about that concern, and I'm actually, and so making the particular calculations that we did, you can show that actually inflation is cheaper to start than a single Boltzmann brain. And so I find this appealing in that regard. Of course, you're making a lot of assumptions, and you have to sort of have a wish list of what holography provides for you and doesn't. And different people have different ideas about whether the Fahey-Guth processes can be used in this way. But I just want to advocate. I think it's actually a really appealing framework. That and so if you've met my student Dan Phillips, who's around, he and I are taking this and some, you know, there's some obvious sort of additional steps you can explore with this, and I find it quite interesting. I think one thing that's clear is we all wish we had a better, more substantial framework for doing cosmology, for knowing that we were using the right laws of physics to do cosmology. I don't really claim I'm any better off here than anyone else, but I do think it has some pretty nice qualitative features, and it is a framework that allows us to calculate a few more things than we have so far. So I'm sort of advocating it as a interesting, potentially very interesting way to think about the universe. So I'm finishing now. I'll just say notions of so I've discussed three challenges that come about by trying to think of a physics of the whole universe. I don't know where all this is going to take us, but I'm having a lot of fun thinking about it. And I'll just mention as a wrap-up, there's a couple of things. I'm intrigued how locality showed up in two places, in the clock ambiguity and in the Born rule crisis via the spin statistics connection, which is when you look at the derivation is connected with locality. The idea of a finite Hilbert space has shown up in all three topics, and the idea of equilibrium has shown up certainly in the last topic, and it has an intriguing connection to the clock ambiguity, which I didn't have a chance to get into, but it's on my checklist of comments at the end, so I'll just leave that thought with you. That it's interesting to think of the connection between these two different ideas. Thanks.
I mean, that clock one seems to be the sort of the point that if you just pick a ray out of the Hilbert space by itself doesn't give any preference for one ray over another. You can just use your M to map together. So it does seem we need something besides just, you know, a ray in the Hilbert space. I guess I sort of long thought, I mean, I had these crazy ideas that maybe it's only conscious perceptions that have probabilities, and tending to, you know, I thought even long before I realized the Born rule fails no matter what you do, I thought that probabilities for conscious perceptions are given by expectation values of operators, but those would be preferred operators, and so, you know, they're not the same as if you apply in to the operator. I mean, it would give some preference. So I don't know. I mean, it seems to support the idea that there's some preferred something, operators, basis, something in the state. You can't just say that it's a completely unadorned Hilbert space with a ray in there, because any ray is equivalent to any other ray.
So the question is, how do you enforce that, and what's the right, what are the right rules, what are the good rules? And the thing, and then the claim is that this is sort of free-for-all cosmology, which is how we tend to think with these infinite universes and different degrees of freedom assembling themselves into semi-classical behavior here, there, and everywhere, doesn't, I don't think, bodes well for supporting a particular set of rules. Although maybe, or maybe we could, maybe you know, principles can ride on top of that, like quasi-separability, like locality, maybe a few other things, I don't know. But I'm just intrigued by that, and not quite sure how to solve it.
Actually, if you had, say, maybe two harmonic oscillators, and maybe you could go through this, can you use one harmonic oscillator as a clock?
Yeah.
And then there's no issue.
But you could take a combination of their of the Hilbert space and do a different clock and get a different behavior. But then, so if you want to claim, if you want to say, I want to cling to this decomposition, that's fine, but that's not what we tend to do in cosmology. We tend to say, well, what combination of degrees of freedom are becoming semi-classical in this patch of the universe or that patch of the universe? And so in that context, you can't hang on to the laws of physics. So that relates to what I said about the laboratory case. Laboratory case, it's clear cut. This is not how we do physics. We don't go mystical about what part of the Hilbert space is what until we start doing cosmology. And then I think we've set ourselves up for this. Maybe the answer is we have to rein in cosmology, but I'm just leaving you with the puzzle rather than giving an answer. Maybe both are true. Maybe this kind of random laws of physics is going to work, but it's also going to tell us about a finite Hilbert space, but keeps cosmology under better control. I don't know.
Okay, so it's no other questions, so let's thank Andy again.